IMDb.
I was praising your jingle work and then you went all, oh, it's really derivative of sucking on my titties.
It's of Peaches, Peaches by Peaches. Yeah, which is a terrific, it's a terrific song. As soon as I wrote that one, not the Peaches by Peaches, I wrote the jingle. I tell you what, we'll pop it in a bit later in this episode. You'll hear it. And as soon as I finished it, I sat back and listened to it. Bear in mind, having listened to each individual part as I'd written them, numerous times, once it was all put together, I sat back and listened to it and I went, oh, it's Peaches by Peaches. Fuck.
Is it a nod to that walking on the beaches, thinging down the beaches?
I don't think so. Walking on the beaches, down by the beaches, da-da-da. I don't think so.
Yeah, but
it sounds very different to that.
No, but like they listened to that and then thought, peaches, beaches, peaches.
Maybe. I mean, if that was the case, it would be that they listened to that and then said, not only will we write a song called Peaches, which sounds like beaches in that song, but also we'll name our band Peaches and everything about us will be peach related. So it feels unlikely. Do you know, by the way, good fact. Here's two facts. I'm coming hot with facts, okay? Fact number one, Peaches by Peaches, if you listen to that song, the first time I ever heard that, by the way, was in the soundtrack to Lost in Translation. It's the song that's playing in the strip club when Bill Murray walks in and Scarlett Johansson, walks in and Bill Murray sort of sat there not sure where to look, you know, he knows where to look. But the point is, when you listen to that song, what you'll hear is that it's actually a live recording from the first time they ever played it in front of people. It's the whole thing. It's just like a tape deck live recording performance of one person. It's amazing, right? Fact number two. You ready for fact number two? It's even hotter. Ready? Piping hot, because it relates to temperature. Do you know how people say, don't put hot food in the fridge?
Yeah.
I always assumed, and I'd be curious to hear if this is your assumption too, that the reason you don't do that is because it can, you know, the quick reduction, the fast reduction of temperature of warm food going into a cold environment would be bad for the food itself, right? Is that what you thought?
Well, like in terms of bacteria.
Yeah, that's not what it is at all. Do you know what it is?
It's raising the temperature of the fridge.
It raises the temperature. It's bad for the other food that's already in the fridge. Yeah, so, I mean, if you've got an empty fridge, I mean, that was put hot food in it, that's fine.
That was my second guess was the most obvious second reason.
Well, it's Professor Richmond, I'm very sorry, we don't all have your level of intuitiveness when it comes to bacteria and temperatures. I think lots of the people listening to this, like I had spent their entire life thinking that it was about the hot food. But it's not about the hot food, it's about the cold food. And sometimes life just flips on you like that, you know? You're not expecting it. You're ducking and weaving and bobbing and all of the other forms of evasive action that one can take, maneuvers. And then life just slaps you in the face with something like that and you go, I've been living thinking one thing, whereas in fact, it was another thing the whole time, you know?
Yeah, sorry, I just got a WhatsApp from my wife.
Oh.
Finished late, home in about 8 minutes. Heat my pasta in 5! !
Well, I hope you don't put it in the fridge immediately after you've done that.
You caught me just watching a bit of Vice.
Oh, really? Miami Vice?
No, the film Vice with Christian Bale.
What, the Vice YouTube channel?
Oh, I wish it was actual Vice, you know.
Right, yeah.
No, I remember, you know, it was lobbed in by a listener.
Yeah.
And I'd seen a bit of it. I'd forgotten how much I'd watched of it because I had to go back to near the beginning.
Your thing is always that you'd never seen it before.
No, I said I'd seen half of it and then had to stop.
Yeah.
And then I started rewatching it and I thought, oh, I haven't seen this bit. And I had to go back to, I thought I was halfway through and I've got back, I went back to the beginning and I've got back to halfway through. And at the midpoint, I went, oh, yeah, no, that I have. This is exactly where I left off.
Right,
so I could have finished the whole movie. It does this really fun little fake out ending at midpoint where the credits roll. It's really funny. It's really that's nice. And I'm looking forward to watching the second half now.
That reminds me of in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, God.
Of course, it does, you might think. In Fellowship of the Ring, the first of those three films, when the hobbits, Frodo, Sam, Pippin and Merry, they arrive at Rivendell and they've successfully evaded the Nazgul on Weathertop. Aragorn saved them and they've been delivered to Lord Elrond.
He's had a sword to the shoulder.
Oh, he's had a sword in the torso. Yeah, right in the shoulder.
And the wound will haunt him.
The wound will never heal. Yeah, it really won't heal, you know. Yeah, yeah. Some wounds just, you know, some wounds stay.
Like, I feel like the Nazgul are very much, they represent women and, you know, the wounds that they can inflict on men. And that's why
what Tolkien was saying.
I think that's why I find Tolkien's work deeply problematic, because there's this underlying misogyny. That's not me projecting. You know, no. I just feel like that's in the text.
I think it's there because I've always thought that as well. And that's not me projecting. If two of us are thinking that, it must be about women because. But having said that, I also thought Sauron was a woman. So I'm not, you know, and when Saruman is trying to bring down the mountain, I thought maybe this is something to do with the menstrual cycle. I don't, you know, I thought it could be something to do with hormonal imbalances, you know?
Smaug, you know, what is Smaug if not an anagram of woman?
Yeah, and with a very phallic head.
Sorry. So tell me what after that bit, yeah.
Well, they're at Rivendell and they've been delivered to Lord Elrond. Frodo's been saved. And he's having a little chat with Sam. He's just reconnected with Uncle Bilbo. And he says to Sam, "The ring will be safe here in Rivendell, Sam. We've done our job. We can go home." And Sam does a big Sam-like smile. And then it quickly, you know, it cuts after that to Elrond and Gandalf saying, "The ring cannot stay here, Gandalf," you know. But before that, there's a good sort of 10 minutes where it feels like it's wrapping up. And I remember watching it in the cinema.
Wishing
it
would
come out in 2001, was it?
Wishing it. It was like, yes, here we go. We're at the finishing line. This, checking your watch, thinking, lovely, we're ahead of time.
Quite the opposite. I was thinking, I was 11 or 12 years old and I was thinking, hang on, I thought this was like a trilogy or something. How's it ending now? Feels a bit underwhelming. Little did I know that I was about to go on a 3-year journey that would change my life forever.
Hmm.
One extra little tidbit here.
I'm glad you called it a tidbit and not a titbit.
I think I did titbit last week, didn't I? I've been saying titbit. Maybe that was in a work meeting. Someone pulled me up on saying titbit and I thought, oh, yeah, that is wrong.
Really? Why?
Tidbit. Well, because I think it's tidbit, isn't it? Not it titbit.
Is. Yeah, but, you know, they sound so similar. You'd have to be quite pedantic.
I know, but I
think you'll find it's tidbit, and you've been saying titbit. It's like people who say ying and yang. I think you'll find it's yin and yang.
Is it yin and yang?
It's yin and yang.
Whoa, that's mate. Almost as big as the fridge thing.
That's almost as big as titbit.
Well, listen, now, you know how I talk. I talk like this at work, as you know, this is how I talk. When I'm rounding up, I was getting to the end of a thing. I didn't really know where I was going. I'd made some point that I went, you know, it's like a sort of a bit of a titbit, and I enunciated it like that. So someone's, you know, the person wasn't that pedantic. I think they thought I was like making a meal out of the tit, the titbit of titbit.
They thought you were such a contrary little fucker. They thought Joe will use any excuse to say the word tit in a meeting, and he will crowbar it in.
That's right.
But you said, "Oh no, I'm just stupid." I was just trying.
That's what I said. Yeah, I said, "Is it tidbit?" And they all said, "Yeah, we think so." And I was like, "Oh, I've been saying titbit for years." You know, that's it.
Well, anyway, you know, it sounds good. It sounds makes more sense to you throw it away. Titbit. It's a little titbit. But if you go tit, here's a little tit bit.
And I'm making a gesture with my hands and I start to talk about Saruman and menstrual cycles, you know.
It starts to fall to pieces. It's like people who say safe haven, you know, rhythmically it makes sense. But of course, a haven...
You've been here before.
Yeah. A haven ipso facto is safe by its very nature. You don't need to say safe. I'm going to say it every single time.
That's not that unique of an example, Adam.
Is it very unique?
It might be somewhat unique.
Yes, well played. Well played, Joe. You see, you're pretty smart. You know, you knew what a factoid was.
Sure.
But you didn't know what a tidbit factoid was. You didn't know what a tidbit was.
I didn't. Well, there was one more little Lord of the Rings related thing.
One more? Christ.
Now, listen, I was watching TikTok.
Right.
I was swiping past various videos. And then, I don't know if you've ever seen these videos. They'll be on Instagram as well. They're not specific to TikTok, but they're a really cool style of video. I think they're artificially intelligently enhanced, right? They're AI enhanced, but the theme is always, what if X film was made vertically? And so it starts with just the 16:9, the normal shape of the film in the middle of the screen, and then as it starts, it expands upwards and downwards, and it with a generative fill, the top and the bottom of the screen are filled in, usually with like foreground and background type styles where there aren't moving elements there, but it really changes the perspective of the films, and some of them look amazing. You know, like this Lord of the Rings one left me thinking, wishing I that there was some way I could go and watch the whole thing in portrait, just because it's so, you know, it's so cool, and it really gives you a perspective on why directors choose certain shots as well, and like how close they are to the person, what someone being smaller and in the middle of the screen tells you about them and their emotional state at the time or the situation.
I mean, that's what the cinematic language of a cut and a shot is like. Look at this. And, you know, the grammar of cinema. And then what this is just, AI is just going, nah, forget it. There is no such thing as grammar. There is just the all-seeing eye of Sauron. Sauron? Am I right?
Sauron. I think so,
and it's going to just observe everything and reveal everything. And everyone's going to go, oh, isn't this look cool?
Isn't this look cool indeed? I think that is one way of looking at it.
It probably does.
Another way of looking at it is it's just a cool little thing to watch for 60 seconds.
I was just being facetious. Carry on.
Of course you were. That's your thing. And as is your want. But anyway, I was watching this one. It was a Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. And it's got some lovely music over it. It's got some sad TikTok music. And it's got... it chooses one monologue and has a kind of montage of over cuts of, you know, beautiful sequences from the film. But I'm watching this and I begin to weep. I'm crying.
I'm chuffing
up tears in the daytime on my phone.
On your phone.
And it's because it's one of the most moving passages, moving monologues from Lord of the Rings. It's at the end of the second film, and it's a conversation between Sam and Frodo. And as it was happening, I was thinking about you saying last week how shit all the hobbits were and how they should have replaced them all. And I couldn't disagree with you more in that moment, and I still can't now, because I listened to Sam, Sean Austin, explaining to Frodo, Elijah Wood. He's saying, it's like the stories of old, Mr. Frodo. That's not a bad impression, is it? That's pretty good.
Have you got the script? Could I be Frodo and you be Sam?
No, there's no Frodo. It's just Sam's monologue. Oh, it's just monologue. Sam. That's all it is. Yeah.
So what does
This is what Mr. Samwise Gamgee says to Mr. Frodo. He says this.
It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo. The ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end. Because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, the shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come, and when the sun shines, it will shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you. That meant something, even if you were too small to understand why.
Yeah.
That's, do you know what? Come on. That's a good bit of script writing. It's powerful, but at the same time, I'm watching that and thinking, yeah, but you're in a story, Sam.
Sure.
You're in a fucking story, and you're using story against Frodo and me as a viewer to try and trick me into thinking that you're not a story, but you are a story.
I think that's because you're afraid of love. It's not on you. I think it's on your parents. But it is your thing.
No, it's not on me.
Because I listened to that bit and I think, okay, two things. The ending, I get the ending. That's the fantasy bit, that there is some good in the world and it's worth fighting for. It's the bit before that moves me. It's the how could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad has happened? I think that's true for, you know, that can be true for everyone, right? What is bad in someone's life is relative to their life experiences. Everyone's had the worst thing that's ever happened to them, you know, and everyone's experienced something that has caused them to, you know, inexorably change afterwards, and where you can never go back to who you were before. That for me is the beautiful thing about Lord of the Rings. Obviously it's fantasy, it's high fantasy, and it's got these very clear values and this very easy to understand and comprehend moral structure, which when people are trying to escape from complicated real life, that's a nice, easy thing to grab onto. But the ending of Lord of the Rings is so incredible to me because Frodo can't go back, because all this stuff has happened and he has to keep going forwards. He has to leave Middle Earth and go with Gandalf because the Shire's not for him anymore. You know, there's a bittersweet acknowledgement at the end of the story that even though he's been through this whole thing, and he's changed the world and he's saved the world doing it, the things that happened to him along the way, they've changed him forever. He can't ever go back, you know? And I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Everything, I was really tuning into that, and it was everything you were saying applies to Ethan Hunt and Mission Impossible, mm-hmm. and also like a post 9/11 world.
Sure.
A post 9/11 world. I mean,
yeah, you can't go back.
Yeah, you threw a Mission Impossible 3 line at me, uh-huh. about, like, quite snarkily about, oh, you know, the thing I love about Julia is she represents everything before.
Yeah.
And then you cut it in a very great way in the episode. You went, that's 9/11, that is. And then you had a little funny jingle. Everything you just said applies to Mission Impossible. And you Impossible is my Harry Potter. And you're sure. wrong. Mission Impossible is my Lord of the Rings.
And I will accept that.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host, and Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast, or the Films You Forgot podcast. Either way, you know, pick your poison. I am your host, as ever, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever is the old, well, I say as ever, it's been a dusty long while. It's the old Leaky Bucket Boy, and the Leaky Bucket Boy, he's been away, he's been filling his bucket with footballs, if you can imagine that. And the footballs have all been dropping into his bucket.
And don't fit that well together in a bucket. They're like the work. Do you know when you get those science experiments in school where you fill a thing with like solids and then the teacher goes, but look, water can still fit. And you go, yeah, I understand. Imagine trying to put footballs in a bucket. It's totally inefficient.
Horrible business. So I've been all alone. I don't know if you can detect the resentment, but it's there. But here he is. He's back. It's Joe Devine. Mr. Joe Devine.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that extra traditional mark of respect there. And let me say, what a day to be back. And I'm very excited to get my filthy chops into this one.
This is the podcast in which we chat about the movies you forgot. On today's episode, it is La Confidential. It's the 1997 LA Confidential, directed by Curtis Hanson.
Oh.
It's adapted from the book of the same name, written by James Ellroy.
Yep.
And here is the letterboxed. Everything is suspect. Everyone is for sale, and nothing is what it seems. Three detectives in the corrupt and brutal LA police force of the 1950s use differing methods to uncover a conspiracy behind the shotgun slayings of the patrons at an all-night diner. I have the book in my house on my bookshelf, written by James Ellroy.
Yeah.
I'm an Ellroy guy. I've got all his books, and let's read the book blurb.
Okay.
This is what separates film cunts from book Legends.
Ooh.
Okay.
That's what's written on the back of the book.
Yeah.
A bit presumptuous, isn't it?
Christmas, 1951, Los Angeles, a city where the police are as corrupt as the criminals. Six prisoners are beaten senseless in their cells by cops crazed on alcohol. For the three LAPD detectives involved, it will expose the guilty secrets on which they have built their corrupt and violent careers. Now that is a book blurb.
That's really good. I like that. Yeah. And do you know what that reminds me of, Adam?
Tell me.
It reminds me of how well the film opens, which is, I'm sure, something that we'll come to discuss. But it does something, it sets out its stall in a very similar way to the back of the book there.
It does. The flick is 138 mins. I would usually gripe about that. But this, I saw this film when it came out in 1997, before I cared about runtime. It's a healthy runtime, and I don't think it outstays its welcome. And it obviously stars. Come on, let's do the cast.
Well, now.
Rusty Crowe.
Oh.
Guy Pearce.
Yep.
Kevin Spacey.
Yep.
Kim Basinger.
Well, here's one. Do you say Basinger?
I'm glad.
Because I always wondered if it was like, if it was
Basinger.
I always said Basinger or Basinger.
Basinger?
It's not a J. Is it a J or is it a G? Kim Basinger? Is that what we're going to say?
I think it's Basinger, but you can go Basinger, Basinger.
Basildon? Kim Basildon?
Let's do Kim Basildon. Although she's the only female, I feel if we disrespect her name.
I'm going to disrespect the man. We've already disrespected Rusty Crowe. Come on. It's a little tricky to work out the best way to disrespect Kevin Spacey, but I'm sure with Guy.
I mean, just saying.
Maybe
his
we can
name.
Call Guy Gal Pierce. That'll be fun. You know?
Gal Pierce. I don't mind that.
No,
Danny.
Right.
Danny Daniel DeVito.
Yep.
Jim Cromwell of Babe fame.
That's right. That'll do, Piggy.
That'll do, Pig.
And Noah from The Bourne Ultimatum. David Strathairn.
I said yes. David Strathairn. A really underrated character actor. He's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, also, Paul Guilfoyle. I don't know how you say his name. Paul, he plays Mickey Cohen. I mean, he's barely in it, plays Mickey Cohen, but he's a terrific character actor as well. He pops up in a lot of things. There's so many people in this film that I recognise, but I perhaps don't know who they are, you know?
Before we do dive in, my only beef with this film on rewatching it is how amazing the sort of that top level cast is and how fucking shit the sort of sub, like, walkers on, hangers on, actors are they are glaringly shit, and it really bugged me. That's the only thing that really bugged me on rewatching it.
Say I really noticed that.
Yeah, I've seen this film many times. It's been a long time since I rewatched it, and that was my only beef. Tell me, how is this a movie you forgot, Joe?
Well, I watched this about 15 years ago, just the one time. Obviously not at the time of release. I watched it on DVD. I was aware that it was a film that I should have seen or should see, you know, one on the list, as it were. I've got the DVD somewhere. I remember seeing the front cover and the case of it in all the HMVs, you know. It was around. And so I picked it up one day and I stuck it on, and I just didn't jive with it at all. I was confused. It's a little bit nebulous at times. I didn't really appreciate any of the acting. I thought it was boring, and I couldn't understand why it was one of those films that everyone, or not everyone, but lots of people talked about and was, you know, as highly considered as it is. And then I popped it away for 15 years and didn't think about it really again until you suggested doing it for this podcast.
This is perfect. You are the perfect viewer. I have no idea what you thought of it. You've watched it today.
Yeah, I didn't tell you.
You didn't tell me. Here we go. This is it. We're starting now. Unleash. What does Joe today think of this movie?
I think it's very good. I really liked it. I liked it less as it went on. At the beginning, I thought I was incredibly pleased with how well it was all going. I thought, what was I on about 15 years ago? I thought the introduction of the characters, the stories, the weaving of stuff was brilliant. The tone is all perfect. The bit where I lose the high degree of interest I had and it dips down slightly is when Kevin Spacey, Jack Vincennes, Kevin Spacey, the police officer, goes round to the house of Dudley Smith, played by James Cromwell, the sort of captain, but essentially the chief of police in for all intents and purposes in this film, and is killed by him. So that it surprised me. I'd completely forgotten that had happened. I mean, by the way, I forgot everything about this film. I forgot Russell Crowe was in the film, right? So it's a deep, deep level of forget. It's a deep vein thrombosis version of forget. But I didn't see it coming at all. And I thought, but then as soon as it happened, I thought, oh, yeah, that's kind of boring. And also, Kevin Spacey, putting everything Kevin Spacey related aside, he's fucking amazing in the film.
He is.
I don't know how to say that. Like, I get the awkwardness of saying that, or the awkwardness of that conversation. But, you know, without condoning Kevin Spacey's personal life or anything in relation to it, I don't know about it. I'm not reading it. I'm getting caught up in myself saying this. Kevin Spacey, his performance in the film is exceptional. He's one of the best things about it. And so when he dies, the film naturally gets a bit worse without him. But also, it takes this turn where, although it is necessary to bring together the other two weaving storylines of Rusty Crowe and Guy Pearce, and that's something that you want to happen as a viewer, it just turns into a big shootout thing, and it has like a very dissatisfying for me ending. I didn't feel as though, and I'm willing to accept if this is partly my problem, I didn't feel as though it really landed the message or the ending. And I thought there was some, the first two thirds of the film are so good that it just felt a little bit disappointing for me at the end. But in terms of in comparison to my memory of watching it for the first time round, well, I mean, yeah, it's a brilliant film with some questionable bits.
Yeah, I think that's a good show. I mean, in terms of a movie adaptation of a fairly densely plotted book, it's pretty good. There is.
Are we talking about Lord of the Rings again, or are we still on LA Confident? Because I can see
that is a lovely, lovely, lovely joke, and that means we have to include the 20-minute opener we just recorded.
It's a little turn of events, there, isn't it? Yeah.
Wait! Stop!
I always liked going south. Somehow, it feels like going down a hill.
No, it sounds like I'm talking about Lord of the Rings there, but I'm actually talking about L.A. Confidential.
Oh, L.A. Confidential. Yeah, sorry.
Written by James Ellroy.
Yeah. James Elrond.
Christ alive.
Am I right?
Yeah, the movie kind of has to wrap up with a shootout. And when you read the book, it's very much about the three detectives. Bud White, played by Russell Crowe. Uh-huh. Ed Exley, played by Guy Pearce, and Jack Vincennes, played by Kevin Spacey.
Played by K-Pax.
You have this looming, dark police figure, Irish cop called Dudley Smith, who's played by James Cromwell, looming over all of them. And they are all
who
these...
Who nails the accent, by the way? Sorry to interrupt, but like I think the wobbly Irish, American thing, I think it's brilliant.
And in the book, it's kind of it's suggested that it's an affected brogue.
Ah.
It's referred to it as a brogue.
That's cool.
And so the film gets away with it as well. because he plays it up. He loves that. He's that American Irish guy.
When he's saying old Irish sayings and stuff, he gets more Irish. My uncles all do that.
Exactly. But the book is this perfect vision of these three completely contained individuals with their own individual burning arcs, and they're all driven by different things, and they've all got different desires, and you just want them to click and connect and share the knowledge of the crime, of the shootout. Please come together, please be friends.
And that happens, Elroy, you get that from the film, right?
Yeah, and Elroy keeps them apart for so long, and that's what's so compelling about that, and the film does a great job of that. And you're right, when Vincennes dies then, and in the film has gotta get to that finale and wrap things up in a fairly rote, you know, shootout.
Yeah.
The book can take a hell of a lot longer. There's loads more characters. There's a lot more time spent with one of the victims of sexual violence. It's a big plot detail. There's all these other characters you can spend a lot more time with.
Let me just interject very quickly. I want you to get back onto this exact train of thought. And this isn't another opportunity for me to rope in Lord of the Rings. But no, the description. No,
this has got to be the ongoing parallel. If it's okay. Not, I'd be really disappointed.
The description of the book, the multiple perspective, and these different people, how you want them to get together. You're describing high fantasy literature. Like, this is what happens in all high fantasy literature. You have three characters. You love them all for their individual strengths. They all have their individual burning arcs. And you know as a reader that they're going to cross paths and they're going to get together at some point, and you want desperately for them to be friends. That is every high fantasy book ever written. And I honestly think maybe this is like Lord of the Rings, but set in LA and dressed up as police officers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna argue with that at all. It's all genre, isn't it? And it's the dressing on top and the tone and the vibe.
That's right, man.
It's all storytelling.
It's like the noir wheel of time, you know?
Right. But the film does a fantastic... What
Rusty
film?
Crowe as Randall Thor. This is something that won't mean anything to you, but, you know, Randall Guy Thor. Pearce as Perrin.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely, absolutely.
Kim Basinger as Egwene.
As Tom Bombadil.
There you go, exactly.
Tom Bombadil.
Of course.
Kevin Spacey as Tom Bombadil.
That's it, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, the film does a great job of that, but it can only ever end like a Hollywood film. It's still a big Hollywood film.
It's set in Hollywood.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's fair enough. What are you going to do? I never had a huge problem with it.
It's just boring and disengaging. I like the shootout. I know what's going to happen. I don't really care. It's not particularly exciting to watch. It's funny that Rusty Crowe's in a hole in the floor. You know, I like that. But like, I think the film's just getting good. They're just unraveling. They've just got together, as you've described. And then someone says over the police intercom, "Hey, Ed Exley, you've been called. But why wants you to meet him at some hotel?" And I'm like, "Well, that's obviously not true, is it? You know." And then they get there and they work it out. And then they're just it's like a big sign saying the end of the movie has arrived. And I'm going, "Well, hang on, it was just getting good."
It's also there's a big jump in logic, in kind of plot logic for Bud White's character. He realizes something far too late in the flow of events. It's the only second thing that it bugged me, because I know the story so well. It's kind of this rushed revelation. He has a flashback to something he saw at the beginning. He clocked it at the beginning. He sees a dead body, and I don't know. I'm explaining it badly, but it's a function of the plot, and it's been held back for him, for his character, to have the revelation later. So it's a very small niggle, but I think they don't make movies like this anymore. This would now be made as a 10-part Netflix or Apple TV series.
Absolutely. Are we going to cast that?
We could cast it, but I mean, I don't want to see that though.
I do.
I think read the book then, because...
Well, yeah, but I don't want to read the book. I want to watch it on the TV.
But these problem with these prestige set in the past things is they take themselves so seriously and they get the source material so wrong. They kind of flesh out stuff that isn't interesting. They pad out stuff. They generally fuck it. And I don't know how you fuck up an Elroy book, but I could just see them easily fucking it up. I didn't like the Ripley thing they did on Netflix. I don't know how you fuck up Highsmith. You know, this is what they do. It becomes about the whoever the showrunner is. It's all about their vision, and unless you get exactly the right person,
Joe Pompiliano, whatever his name is, the guy who made True Detective, you know.
Nick Pizzolatto.
Yeah, Joe Pompiliano.
And maybe would I take Nick Pizzolatto? He seems like he's a bit of a dick.
I'm sure he's a bit... Hey, man, to make a TV show that good, you must be a bit of a dick.
No, he made the first one that everyone loved.
Yeah.
Everyone hated the second.
I really liked the second.
He got kicked off. He's right. Not even done the fourth.
I didn't watch the fourth.
I started watching the fourth and it was shit.
I heard it wasn't very good. I enjoyed the third. And I rewatched the second because I never finished it the first time round. And when I stuck with it, it's very different to the other two. Like, it's a wild departure, but it's actually brilliant.
Okay, forget that. I've just figured out who's going to do this. Oh. David Chase, The
who's
Sopranos.
That? Oh.
David Chase.
Well, but...
Or Matthew Weiner, who did Mad Men. These are the guys you need.
A bit fucking obvious, isn't it?
Oh, it's not fucking awards for obscurity.
I said Joe Pompiliano. That's not...
Yeah, but Nick Pizzolatto's nothing. He did one TV show. He's not got any fucking... He's got nothing else on his roster.
Yeah, he's free. He's available.
I don't know if you can get
the guy who did The Sopranos. I think that's cheating. You can't say that. You can't okay, say fine. David The Wire, whatever that guy's name is. What's his name?
Oh, you can't say David Simon. You can't say Vince Gilligan.
You can't say Steven Spielberg. Who would you get to make a film? Oh, I don't know. Fucking Steven Spielberg.
That's good.
Actually,
That's a great rule. If someone
I'd
says,
revive Alfred Hitchcock. You know, come on, man. What is this?
David Chase is
what do you like to eat? Chocolate, you know. Yeah, everyone likes chocolate. Come on.
Right, okay, fine. I reject Pizzolatto, though.
Okay, yeah. Well, we'll have to take... My project will go to Disney and yours will go to Netflix and we'll just see, won't we?
Yeah, we're going to see who gets the race of LA Confidential to the streamers first.
What it made me wish for, though, just on a serious note about your, I think, a very accurate observation that this film would today, had it been made, be a 10-part or a 6-part TV series, streamer series, whatever. I'm sure he's been in some, but I would love, capital L, to see Rusty Crowe in that sort of environment. I feel like I haven't seen that, and I think he would suit it down to the ground.
Well, he's definitely, you know, hungry for work.
Is he? We said this before. I feel like... I feel like just because he's not working as much doesn't mean he's hungry.
Maybe he's
eaten already. I think he's feasted. I think this guy's had enough. He's eaten enough to last a lifetime. He doesn't need to eat. Anything he eats now is just because he's, you know, it's like when you're lying around, you've had a whole meal, but there's just the one grape there and it looks like a real good grape. And you're like, I'll have that grape.
He's doing a lot of shit. They're not grapes. He's picking off like withered blackberries.
One man's grapes are another man's blackberries. You know.
No, honestly, like he's picking some real shit and he could be in prestige telly. And not that I think, I mean, maybe it's more fun that he's in shit TV, shit films. But
Hey, Rusty, you could be in a prestige picture.
he should be doing what Winslet is doing, prestige telly that no one watches.
Right, yeah.
You know, why not? At least prestige.
Yeah,
at the minute, everyone's laughing at him.
No one's laughing at Rusty Crowe. They are.
We're
God,
not.
You're always saying this, everyone's laughing at Rusty Crowe. And I'm thinking, I wake up to text messages from you saying everyone's laughing at Rusty Crowe. Like, what have you been awake all night? You sent this at 4 a.m, you know?
Can I read you...
Some of the book? Yeah, all right.
Do you want to get a
what,
vibe?
Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, you wish.
I do.
You wish.
I wish this podcast was just you reading Lord of the Rings.
James Ellroy is one of the finest living writers. Okay, his books are jazz, violent, staccato, labyrinthine plots. They can get quite samey language-wise, but...
Like Alsatians, yeah? Great dog, but once you've seen five, you've sort of seen all the Alsatians.
Yeah, but if you pay attention, you can get the nuances.
Okay.
This is the bit where there's the big prison riot. The whole film hangs on. There's a big prison riot.
Yeah.
Then we jump cut to the massive prison fight.
Uh-huh.
The music inside went off key. Wrong. Not really music. Bud caught screeches, screams from the jail. The noise doubled, tripled. Bud saw a stampede, muster room to cell block. A flash, Sten's going crazy, booze, a jamboree, bash the cop bashes. He ran over, hit the door at a sprint. The catwalk packed tight, cell doors opening, lines forming, Exley shouting for order, pressing into the swarm, getting nowhere. Bud found the prisoner list, all six cop beaters in custody. The bums in the drunk cage egged the men on. Sten hit the number four cell, waving brass knuckles. Willie Tristiano pinned Exley to the wall. Crumb Crumley grabbed his keys. Cops shoved cell to cell. Elmer Lentz, blood splattered, grinning. Jack Vincennes by the watch commander's office. Lieutenant Freeling snoring at his desk. Bud stormed into it. He caught elbows going in. The men saw who it was and cleared a path. The mechs kicked him in the balls, a dangling shot. Bud keeled into the bars. The kid stumbled out of the cell, smack into Vincennes. Trash can, aghast. Blood on his cashmere blazer. He put the punk down with his left right. Exley ran out of the cell block. Voices, attaboy, big bud, faces to the voices, skewed, wrong, Exley still dumping, Mr. Teetotaler witness, Bud ran down the catwalk, locked him in tight. And that's the end of the chapter. Right. I mean, it's all powerful stuff. Sorry. You can just lose all of that if you want. Have you looked at the films that came out in 1997?
No, because I assumed you were going to
tell you. How old are you in 1997?
Well, which month?
I don't know. February.
Six.
6 years old?
In February of 1997, I'm 6 years old. Trash can, aghast.
I am in my cinematic pomp in 1997.
I bet you are all peacocking around everywhere, aren't you? I've seen a new film. You've never seen anything like it. When you'd listen to the Sex Pistols. It's the same thing.
No, that's like 5 years later when I'm in my insufferable 20s.
Right, yeah.
This is me. I'm 16.
Right.
Hoovering things up. I'm a blank slate.
Well, I know you wanted to talk about the best films of 1997. So I thought I'd give you the opportunity to do that through reading a list that I found online from Collider.com.
Yeah, I always love these lists, don't I? They always go down really well.
They always sort of match what you're saying and what you think about the year. So would you like to guess which films are on the best of 1997 list, the Collider.com list?
Well, Titanic is obviously there.
Titanic is there. It's number one, Titanic. Told by the 101-year-old Rose DeWitt Bucatta. Is that really her name?
Why isn't it better for me just to list...
Rose DeWitt Bucatta.
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 Bukkake.
Is it better for me to list
the films from 1997?
I just want to know how similar to yours your list is to Collider. That's kind of what's happening. It's your listing films that are on your list, and I'm telling you whether they're on this list or not. That's all it is.
I don't have a list. I'm just glancing at Letterboxd, and I want to know what have you seen from 1997.
Okay.
You know, we had a big argument about strong year, not strong year.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Let's do this bit.
If I read out, close your hand. Close your fist.
Close my head.
Close your fists.
My fists are closed. Okay. Yeah.
And I'm going to say a number of films, And when it's a strong film,
yeah,
I want you to say strong film, and I want you to flick up one of those digits.
Okay, yeah.
That's all I want.
I'm ready to go.
So I think this is... I'm going to turn the tables, and I think you need to play a game.
I'm really glad to see, by the way, just before we begin, that that criticism that came in via email last week hasn't buried into your head like it normally would. I think you've grown in strength over the last year.
And, what's the criticism?
Oh, just that all we ever do is list films, you know. But no, you read it to me and I'll just say, I'll say strong film and I'll put up fingers. Let's go.
This will make it quicker. Good Will Hunting.
Yes, strong film.
Titanic.
No, one of the worst films ever made.
Brilliant. Princess Mononoke.
Strong film.
Men in Black.
Strong film.
Boogie Nights.
Strong film.
Jackie Brown.
Strong film.
Life is Beautiful.
I haven't seen it.
Scream 2. You haven't seen it. Don't worry. The Game. The Fifth Element.
Strong film.
Lost Highway?
No.
Gattaca.
Strong film.
Starship Troopers.
Oh, strong film.
Devil's Advocate.
Strong film.
Face Off.
I haven't seen it, but I know you like it.
Liar Liar.
Is that with Jim Carrey?
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen it.
You're like, it's good fun, man. Donnie Brasco?
Don't really care about that, but I know people say it's a strong film.
Maybe mid-strong. As Good as It Gets?
Again, you know...
That's a weird...
Mid-strong, maybe? I don't know. I don't care about it.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You know, live
this by is my your... This is just my list, right?
Just your list, yeah. Okay. Full Monty.
Strong film.
Gross Point Blank.
I don't like it.
Oh, Ice Storm?
Haven't seen it.
Mouse Hunt?
I mean, I've suggested that we do it on this podcast because I don't remember anything about it, so I can't really make a comment. But I've heard you referring to it as one of the great comedies.
Right. On that bombshell, how many have you flicked up on your hands?
10.
What do you think that says about 1997?
That it's a strong year.
Great. That's it. That's the end of the game.
Right. When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. You want to talk about Danny DeVito, don't you? Because you love Sonny.
He's a fascinating man, Danny DeVito, and I think is a fabulous actor. I think what's interesting to me about Danny DeVito is that whilst I've seen him in many a movie, I feel like I know him best and primarily know him for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. The I think it's now the longest running network comedy American TV show on air.
Because he plays such a striking character.
Yes.
In that. Had you ever seen him in anything else before you really got into Sunny?
Yeah.
What would you familiar with him?
Well, as the Penguin.
Yeah, good shout.
Yeah. I'd seen him in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, that's his... Breakout.
That's the Breakout.
Do you want to say who he plays in LA Confidential?
Yeah. He's a terrific character.
He plays Sid Hudgens. Yeah, a weathered, sleazy tabloid journalist who frames a lot of the exposition.
Like the opening, this is what the strongest thing about this film, I think, is the opening. Because it starts with old Hollywood music. It starts with all these scenes of, you know, sun and actors and movie stars and, you know, the life that one might expect upon moving to Hollywood. And there's a voiceover. It's Danny DeVito. You can hear him immediately. He's got that, incredibly recognizable voice. And he's saying, Hollywood, you know, what a great place for people to come and have a good time and whatever. Or so they thought after a few seconds. And so I'm watching this and I'm thinking, wow, this is a phenomenal opening to a film. I'm getting the setting off the top. I'm excited. It's bringing me in. It's giving me tone and vibe tone. And timbre and all of it. Like you're just absorbing it. There's a huge sense of familiarity of this old Hollywood, this old America that you know and love, but you also know isn't quite real. And then halfway through, Danny DeVito's voiceover slams you with, but that's not really what's happening here, you know? And at the same time as the story taking a turn, you're learning more about the film, you're learning about this character that's doing the voiceover as well. And then there's a second twist when you get to the end of this opening voiceover, where you realize that he's narrating a piece that he's writing for his tabloid. And so within the space of 90 seconds, I think it could have served as the trailer for the film, right? And it's perfect. Within the space of 90 seconds, it tells you where the film is set, what the vibe of the film is going to be. It roughly tells you about the story. It sets up these huge, grand expectations, and it gives you so much about this character. And through this character, it tells you what to expect from the other characters in the film as well. It is such a brilliant, I think it's one of the best opening sequences in a film that I've ever seen.
Very heartening. But you're right. And yeah, it's saying this is what it looks like, and there's a horrible, dirty, dark, sleazy, corrupt underbelly.
Well, a truth underneath. And reality, right?
And that's Danny DeVito. So when you were growing up watching movies as a kid, did you watch, so you recognize him as Penguin. Did you watch Twins?
Yeah, I watched Twins, so I knew him as a funny guy alongside Arnie.
Right.
I think the first thing I ever saw him in, though, was Matilda.
Yeah.
In 1996, he plays the sort of foster father, right? Or like the
horrible
adoptive
dad.
Father. Yeah, the horrible
dad. He's the real dad.
Is he the real dad?
Yeah, they're the real parents.
Oh, okay.
I know, that's what makes it so extra interesting. He wrote and directed that as well.
Did he?
Yeah.
No he's way.
Not, yeah.
He's the shit man. Not the shit. He's not the shit man. He's the shit, man.
He's the shit man. He is the shit man, all right.
He's so good in that. And also, I love the way that tells you everything you need to know about Danny DeVito. Is if he wrote, is if he directed Matilda, he thought about having the camera at a slightly awkward diagonal angle, upwards facing right up into his horrible face when he's holding that gun. And he's, you know, he's so ugly as a character in that. I love someone that wants to show that kind of part of themselves on camera, you know?
Hey, that's Danny DeVito.
That's Danny. There's no vanity in Danity.
No, but you are mainly overwhelmed with him being in Sunny as this horrible uncle, whoever the fuck.
He plays Frank, who's sort of the father of two of the main characters. In the first season, there's no Danny DeVito. It's just the four main characters, and they run this bar and whatever. I'm sure lots of people have seen the show.
They all scream at each other.
That's true, but it's also a kind of reduction.
And then
of
in series
funny.
Two, they yeah. had Danny DeVito.
And in series and two, all, and series they, two, they go. Scream I at think each other. we need something else. We need someone else here. They ask Danny DeVito, and he says yes, and he comes along. And at the beginning, he plays like still kind of a weird oddball character, but this slightly more normal guy. He's business savvy. He's made a lot of money. He's got a mouth on him, and he shouts it. Boy, does he shout it. But he's essentially like, you know, a kind of normal adjacent character. And over the course of a number of seasons, he becomes more and more debauched to the stage where he is the most entertaining person to watch in the show. And he's constantly like going under bridges to find stuff and trying to get, you know, crabs out of the river. And he's up to tricks, you know. He's fucking wonderful. He's brilliant. And it's so, I find it very funny to watch, and also amusing to think that here's this, you know, essentially like this big movie star who's doing this really weird show and playing a character that I think many actors wouldn't play. People who took themselves too seriously just wouldn't be able to do it. And he does it so well. But the thing that's interesting to me about it is that that's the main thing I know him for. That's certainly the main thing that a younger audience know him for. Younger people who haven't seen the older Batman films, who were born after Matilda was released, you know, who've never watched LA Confidential. And so I think he's had a very interesting career arc. And when you look through his list of films and his list of projects, Sometimes I think these are you know, sort of strange combination between unusual choices and then things that perhaps he's just interested in. And also I think sometimes, well, this is a list of projects that doesn't quite capture how good an actor he is.
Yeah, I mean, just maybe I don't think the movie business is, that's not what it's there for.
He's not sexy enough.
Well, he's a particularly sized man.
Yeah.
As soon as you cast him in something, you know, you are partly casting Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
And it's a slightly heightened thing. Like, he's in Tim Burton movies. He's in adaptations of Roald Dahl's stuff. So there is... But then he's great in a David Mamet film called Heist, as a kind of a horrible crime lord guy.
2001. Mickey Bergman.
He's amazing as Penguin in Batman Returns.
Yeah.
There is a phenomenal moment in that movie where Christopher Walken is going to make him mayor, and he's brought him up from the sewer. And this guy is showing him, Chris Walken's showing him around his electoral team. He's very much a Donald Trump of Tim Burton very much foresaw Donald Trump when he did that sequence. Danny DeVito is this kind of squat, hobbit, horrible little vicious man who wants to eat raw fish. And... Walken introduces him to this young woman, and DeVito just plays it so gross.
He's nailed fantastic. Gross. He's nailed it.
He nails it, and
he knows what it is to be gross.
Yeah, and he embraces it.
He owns it.
Yeah,
I think that's what's so special about him. I say it again. I think there are many actors who would not go to the places that Danny DeVito goes. But he owns gross, and it's wonderful.
Shall we play the box office game?
I'd bloody love to play the box office game, and I do not know how you're going to do it. I don't know how you're going to do it. 1997, September 21. September 21, yeah. But of course we're going to begin, as we always do, Adam Richman, with the budget, please. Brackets estimated... on IMDb. Now it's 1997, but you know what that means, don't you? There's the two-pronged factor that we must consider. One prong, inflation. The other prong, they don't make them like they used to.
They don't. And then these are pre-big name actors. No one here is an A-lister. If anything, this flick makes Rusty Crowe. It makes Guy Pearce.
Uh-huh.
Kevin Spacey's probably your biggest guy at this time. It's a prestige picture.
It's a prestige picture. No question about it.
It's just phenomenal it got made. But it's still going to cost something. And I reckon it cost $50 million.
Wow.
And I think I over-egged it. I'm over-egged it, but...
What, you want to bring it down? It's always a risk, isn't it?
It is.
But you know what they say? I can't remember what they call it, the three-door problem. You know that one? The three-door theory?
The three-body problem.
Not the three-body problem. You know the thing about the game show problem. You know that one?
No.
It's a problem of statistics. I can't claim to understand it because I try to reread about it occasionally so I can get my head around it. But the setup is as follows. You know, you're on a game show, there's three doors, and the host tells you that behind one of those doors is a brand new Lamborghini or a Ferrari or whatever would be in this noir movie, and behind the other two doors are goats, yeah? And then you've got a guess, you just pick a door. What do you think your chances are of getting it right, statistically speaking?
One in three.
One in three, right, so you've got a 33% chance of getting it right. Now, you pick, doesn't matter which door you pick. Let's say you picked door A, yeah? The host, what does the host do? The host opens door C and shows you a goat. And then says, do you want to swap? Your pick was door A. He showed you what's behind door C. Now there's two doors closed. Do you want to swap? Do you swap or not?
Well, your odds are now like 50-50.
except they're not. And that's the maths problem. Yeah.
Right. Why are they not?
I can't explain it, man. Like you'll have to go and read about it afterwards. And other people are going to have to go and read about it. But it's the I think it's called the three Monty problem. That's what it's called. But essentially, as soon as the host shows you what's behind the other door, you now swap every time to the other one, and you have a 2 in 3 chance of picking the car. And I can't tell you why that is the case.
But
it is the case.
The case is always swap.
Let me just find it. Hold on.
No. It's good. I like the idea that we don't know.
No, but I want to know. I've brought it up into my head again. The Monty Hall problem, it's called. It's a brain teaser in the form of a probability puzzle based nominally on the American television game. So let's make a deal. So it explains the thing. Savant's response was that the contestant should switch to the other door. By the standard assumptions, the switching strategy has a two out of three probability of winning the car, while the strategy of keeping the initial choice only has a 1 out of 3 probability. So it's explained as follows. When the player first makes their choice, there's a 2 out of 3 chance that the car is behind one of the doors not chosen, right? Because you've got a 1 out of 3 chance of getting it when you're picking. This probability does not change after the host reveals a goat behind one of the unchosen doors. So when the host provides information about the two unchosen doors, revealing that one of them does not have a car behind it, the 2 out of 3 chance of the car being behind one of the unchosen doors rests on the unchosen and unrevealed door, as opposed to the 1 in 3 chance of the car being behind the door that you chose initially. Why?
Sure, but why? That's exactly why.
Yeah, why?
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 Doesn't make it clearer.
The given probabilities depend on specific assumptions about how the host and the contestant choose their doors. An important insight is that with these standard conditions, there is more information about doors 2 and 3 than was available at the beginning of the game when door 1 was chosen by the player. The host's action adds value to the door, not eliminated, but not to the one chosen by the contestant originally.
The door is still... The doors are just doors.
Many readers of Savant's column refused to believe that switching is beneficial and rejected her explanation. After the problem appeared in a Parade, approximately 10,000 readers, including nearly 1,000 with PhDs, wrote to the magazine, most of them calling Savant wrong. Even when given explanations, simulations, and formal mathematical proof, many people still did not accept that switching is the best strategy, but Paul Erdos, one of the most prolific mathematicians in history, remained unconvinced until he was shown a computer simulation demonstrating Savant's predicted result. So it's not just you and me that struggle to understand it. It's a paradox, and it seems very counterintuitive, but it is demonstrably true.
Well, okay, if you say so, but
I'm not saying so. Math says
random.
So. It's maths. Weird. It's weird. Yeah. What were we talking about, though? Oh, yeah. We're whether you should come like, down on your
higher or lower. Higher, lower.
Well, as it turns out, this doesn't really apply because it's just a guess.
Basically, if I go up, I get a goat, and if I go down, I get a Lamborghini.
Mm-hmm. Or is it?
Let's stick to 50 then, because you haven't shown me a goat.
Okay, hold on. How about this? Okay, you've picked door number B that has 50 on it. Yeah. Door number C, I'm opening it. That one that you didn't pick, it says 1 billion. That's a goat. So what does that tell you?
It means you want me to switch.
Yeah.
That's what it means.
It does.
So...
you said you over-egged it. How much egg did you put in that salad?
One of those large eggs.
Is that a cat?
Yeah, the cat came back.
The cat came back?
Yeah.
Man, how can you tell me the cat ran away... And that you're sad about it, and then not tell me the cat came back.
I'm sitting here
thinking the cat's dead. I didn't want to bring it up again because I was like, oh, I'm going to rub it in. This cat's definitely dead. I said to you, hey, man, maybe the cat's not dead. And you were like, the cat's definitely dead. And so I said, okay, I won't bring it up again for a bit because probably just reminding him that this cat's dead.
Meowing.
I could hear the little bell on it.
Yeah.
Well, how long was he away for?
2 nights and a bit. We went out, me and my... daughter like handing out leaflets and calling. She called and I got her to post leaflets through people's doors. And you know what, if you want to see how amazing humanity is,
lose a cat.
You need to get the cat first. Don't just lose a cat. Get a cat, have the cat run away. Don't deliberately do that, because then that would defeat the purpose.
Yeah.
Have the cat... The cat runs away. Oh, mate. Humanity.
Did they get out there?
All its pomp and glory just reveals itself to you about how wonderful and how thoughtful and how caring strangers are.
Wow.
In the community.
Did someone call you to identify the cat?
Oh, yeah, Chloe got a really long, mad, rambling message. No, but when you're out looking for the cat in the main,
yeah,
people coming out and kind of, this guy came out of his house, I'm a stranger, in my slippers, I could be anyone, and my kid has just put a leaflet through his door. I'd be angry. Like, who's put a leaflet through my door? And we're wandering around, and he comes out, and he's like, oh, yeah, we saw your cat. He comes out of his home to tell me, oh, yeah, I think we saw him last night. He was, like, playing with our cat. And I was just thinking, oh, my God, this is amazing.
Wow.
How does this happen?
So did he just show up again?
As a result of us doing that, cat comes back. Dennis. Tail between his legs. Literally, tail between his legs. The little shit. He's been very affectionate ever since. He hadn't really gone that far. We've put one of those little Apple trackers on his round his neck in a little collar.
Yeah, get Apple involved. I think that's right.
In case you lose your bag or cat, you can attach this thing to it.
Yeah.
Or him. He's a boy.
Yeah.
So anyway, the cat came back and the cat's here now meowing because he probably wants some food.
Right, right.
And we're playing the box office game. I'm going to say $38 million.
No, I'm not ready to move on yet, because you were just saying, you said, I found it interesting about your story. You said the cat came back as a result of you doing that. Did the cat know that you were out handing leaflets out? Is that, or did someone call and bring the cat back? Or are you just saying the cat? So do you think the cat wouldn't have come back if you hadn't have gone out looking?
That is what I like to believe.
Because right.
My kid, she was really calling out. It was heartbreakingly cute and sad.
Right. Yeah.
Really, really, like, you know, I was embarrassed.
Yeah.
But I still went out.
Yeah, because what's the cat's given name? Not obviously it's called Dennis, but what's his actual name?
Minnie.
So your daughter's out there shouting Minnie. Yeah.
Yeah, but in a really like sweet, high-pitched thing. It's about 7 o'clock at night. It's summer, so it's still the sun's out.
People are in their gardens, you know?
People are, not around here, they're not.
Sure. They wouldn't want to get attacked by rogue cats.
But I'm saying we met a stray cat who looked just like Minnie, but all black, really thin. And we chatted to that cat, and then the cat started following us. And then when our cat came back, I said, I think that stray cat had a chat with our cat, and that's why he came back. And she looked at me and she went, yeah, absolutely.
Right, yeah.
And I think if you say that story, then that's the story. We're talking about fucking cats, man.
Yeah,
You know, who cares?
No.
You know, make it a Pixar movie.
I agree with you. And let me tell you again, it's those stories that mean something, Mr. Frodo.
Exactly.
Mr. Frodo, the cat came back not because it was ready to come back and it was hungry. It came back because it had a conversation with another cat that told it we were out looking for it, Mr. Frodo. It was $35 million. It was. So you were pretty close there, $38 million. I mean, we had to, you know, we nudged you down. But as a result of it, you got in within the 10%. So well done. Congratulations.
Well done. Let's see if we can keep
that up, okay? Because, of course, I told you, it's a 21 SEP, 1997, opening weekend US and Canada. What do you think a movie like this, a prestige picture, what do you think it can take in its opening weekend?
I think this is a grower.
But is it a shower?
Not on first showing.
Mm-hmm.
So I reckon this is making 15?
No, sir. This movie, September 21, made $5,211,000.
That's a real, grower.
You're 200% over.
I know I'm over.
I just wasn't sure if you knew it was 200% or not. I thought I'd say it out loud so that you
200%,
knew.
200%, for me, I'm just like three, I'm just two extra fives out. I'm really close.
Yeah, sure.
But people are going to come to see this because it gets a little bit of Oscar buzz.
Speaking of, we move, of course, to the world of Gross Worldwide. Perhaps that multiplier doesn't apply. Who could say? Who could say? What do you think?
Well, in terms of the other flicks that come out, everyone's banging on about Titanic. Uh-huh. As good as it gets. Uh-huh. Other kind of shit like that, that really grabbing attention. Uh-huh. But I really feel like this is the prestige picture. This is the film that Mystic River wishes it was.
Oh, yeah, big time, big time.
I'd like to think it makes double its money. So I like to think it makes 80 million.
Yeah?
I like to think that.
That's what you like to think.
If it breaks 100, that's phenomenal.
I want to know what you, not what you like, I want to know what you think, Adam Richmond. We acknowledged at the beginning, it's a hardy.
Yeah, but I'm not coming, I'm shooting.
Right now you're shooting from the hip, and I'm looking for you to lift that pistol up to the eyesight, to the eye line.
Okay, if it's doing mega buffo, super, super duper, 150?
126 it does.
Oh, okay.
Pretty good.
That's mate, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah.
On 35.
Unless they spent 100 on marketing.
Should we play the game where one of us reads out a long list of films to try and catch out the other one for a movie they forgot?
I'd bloody love to. I think it's my go this week, Adam.
It is.
Okay, are you ready for me to get you?
Get me.
Here we go. Hail Caesar.
No.
American Pie The Reunion.
Which one is that?
It's the reunion one.
Number three.
No, that's the wedding. The reunion one came out like 10 years ago. It was the most recent one with all them in it, reunioned.
No, I mean, maybe if you'd said wedding, I might have said yes, but not reunion.
All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Never seen it.
You've never seen it?
No.
Shame, shame.
Shame.
I think this is the one.
That's a Hail Mary, that one.
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh, fuck off.
I don't really want to watch it again, but it's a true forgot you forgot for me. It was big cheese that year.
Yeah.
And now it's, you know, what is it? It's gone, right?
Can I have your last one? You've got me on it, really, but I don't have any interest in.
I'll see if I can get you with one more and then you can have a choice, okay? I'd love to do this one. So if you did forget it, Underworld.
No, never saw it.
Never saw it.
I started trying to watch bits of it. You know what? Fuck.
What?
Fuck Ebbing's, Missouri.
Yeah.
I would never. I can't believe you've deliberately forced me down American Pie Alley and you've pulled my pants down in a Stifler-esque maneuver.
It's the reunion, like it. Baby. Yeah.
It's plum because I cannot remember a thing about that. Are they painting a house or something?
No, that's the second one. This is one like much later when they all get back together. Like there's the first three and then there's a big break and then there's the reunion. I don't know what happens in it. I can't remember either. All the same stuff happens in it, I think, but they're older.
Great. And we're going to have to watch all fucking other three so we can talk about the whole series. It's the Mission Impossible problem all over again.
I actually don't need to because I know the others so well. I could probably do with rewatching the third one. I haven't seen that for a long time. But one and two, I actually watched them last year and they're pretty ropey and obviously extraordinarily problematic. But, you know, still a few laughs in there.
Okay. All right. Say that was the LA Confidential episode. Say bye-bye, Shipbreak.
Bye, Shipbreak.